Morning. The court convenes this morning to hear United States against Martinez. We appreciate the cooperation of counsel for both parties in rescheduling the case. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Captain John Shriver, and along with Colonel Mark Teletocci, we represent the appellant Sergeant Inez Martinez Jr. There are three main points of argument on the question presented. First, whether an appearance of partiality existed when the senior judge who arraigned the appellant later sat in the public gallery of the trial in her colonel's uniform, communicated privately with the prosecution across the bar, and then accompanied the presiding judge in the chambers during both recesses and sentencing deliberations. Second, the presiding judge failed to cure the appearance problem at trial, where he could have simply disclosed troubling facts and circumstances on the record and sought waiver from the parties. And third, we believe the appropriate remedy in Sergeant Martinez's case is reversal under the Supreme Court's 1988 decision in Liljeburg, which this court has applied in disqualification.
Counsel, could you repeat your second point again? In particular, which judge were you focusing on in the second point?
The presiding judge, the military judge on the bench during taking
Thank you.
The plea. Turning first to the due process issue.
Counsel, where's prejudice here? Since he got substantial, first of all, he got what he bargained for, then he got it cut, then the CCA intervened, cut it some more, tossed out what the CA had done and cut it some more. So where's the prejudice here?
Judge Stuckey, the prejudice in this case is the core of the due process right and the perception problem. The prejudice.
Are you saying it's structural?
It's a structural problem, and this is a procedural
No, is it structural error? Let me put it this way. If we test for prejudice, do you lose?
No, we don't.
Okay. Why?
Because the rules, 902A, 902D1, 902E, if those are meant to protect anything in the system, it is that an accused will have a trial in front of a judge who both is fair and appears to be fair and impartial.
So it's the second judge you're taking issue with? Don't lose track of his question, but which judge are you taking issue with?
Judge Baker, we take issue with the entire process as it unfolded, and so it is the interactions of both of the judges. It's all of the facts and circumstances that a reasonable.
So in your view, did Colonel M appear to be fair or not? You don't think he appeared to be fair?
No, we don't. We don't, Your Honor. We don't believe that there was an appearance of impartiality as due process guarantees from the actions in concert of both of the judges.
Well, at that point in time, don't you think that from one perspective, you could say that the judges worked in concert to help your client get through a provident guilty plea, which at that point in time is presumably what your client wanted? I realize that his interests have shifted now that we're at this point in time, but at that point in time, the interest is in getting through a provident guilty plea
and
getting the benefit of the pretrial agreement.
Judge Ryan, certainly getting through the guilty plea is a factor to be considered, but I think that what this court is still left with is a process that had a perception problem. It's a process.
Okay, well, you need that. You need what the CCA said, well, that they'll assume that there was an error. So, all right, fine. We'll assume, as the CCA did, that there is a perception problem. So that's the first thing you need, which is a problem. Now, the second thing you need is to show the prejudice, and the prejudice can't be the problem itself.
The underlying Liljeburg analysis, looking at all three prongs, as this court has done repeatedly in its precedent, will certainly concede that prong one is not our strongest, but we do believe that there is some prejudice to the individual there. Again, those three prongs being the risk of injustice to the parties,
So where's the injustice to the party in this case? He got through a provident guilty plea, got the benefit of his pretrial agreement, and got the additional relief in the course of the appellate process that Judge Stuckey identified.
Again, Your Honor, we believe that it is there is a substantial right in that due process guarantee that's embodied in the rules 902A, 902D1, 902D2.
Well, that goes back to my point, which is that's the problem that you've identified, the error that you've alleged. That can't be the prejudice.
Your Honor, we think that it can because of the due process guarantee. I mean, when we look to when we look to applying the objective test and identifying what the error is, I think that there is the next step, as Your Honor has identified, is looking at what the appropriate remedy is and looking at what the prejudice that we can actually identify is. And I think that it is looking at all three prongs of Loebsberg. So the injustice to the parties, that there would be a fair process that was not provided in this case. And then prongs two and three, we think, are certainly very strong in this case, where there's the opportunity to instruct the members of the judiciary about exactly what a fair process should look like.
And what do you take issue with respect to the CCA opinion that didn't already do that?
We think that the opinion has no teeth, Your Honor, where it doesn't actually give any remedy to appellant, where it doesn't set aside the conviction, then we think that it lacks in having any sort of
You're not suggesting that the CCA opinion doesn't make very clear that this is not the preferred process, that this isn't a good process, that this isn't the way that things should take place?
Certainly, in the language that the CCA used, they do identify that this is not the preferred course.
And you're not suggesting that this is anything other than an outlier case. And you're not suggesting that this is a practice as opposed to error that you're alleging in this particular case. Do you understand my point? You're not suggesting that throughout the trial judiciary that judges are coaching and interfering in cases that other judges are presiding over?
Your Honor, we're not alleging that this is a large systemic problem.
What's the injustice either to your client or to the system?
The injustice is that in any proceeding that looks the way this does, where the perception of that reasonable observer who's seeing the process as it actually unfolds, that they're not going to be convinced that this individual received a trial, a court-martial in front of someone who both is impartial and appears to be impartial.
Counsel, I have a question on that, on the reasonable person observing the proceedings, which is what we have said is the standard. But we've also said that it's a reasonable observer knowing all the circumstances. So my question is, at what point in time do we take that snapshot? Do we take that snapshot when the reasonable observer is in the courtroom observing it, or do we take that snapshot in a more of a theoretical perspective after the individual would have been informed of everything that went on? For instance, in this case, had the benefit of all the affidavits and the legal arguments and everything. Which one are we looking at here?
Judge Erdman, I think that we are looking at the reasonable person who was observing the proceeding as they actually unfolded. And certainly the knowing all the facts and circumstances language, the next sentence is that might reasonably question the impartiality. And I think if we focus on everything that they view, it's difficult to draw the exact time where the reasonable observer is in the courtroom. But I think even in this case, if we have a reasonable observer who's there 13 days earlier at the time of the arraignment, then they see someone go actually from the bench back into the public gallery later in the proceeding, and then having these private communications and going into the courtroom, that would seem to be problematic from the observer's perspective. If the reasonable observer isn't there until later in time, it's only there perhaps on the day of the plea inquiry, then they're just seeing a person in senior official in full colonel's uniform communicating with the prosecution and accompanying the presiding judge back into chambers. So I think that the exact moment where the reasonable observer is present isn't as important. It perhaps is focusing on how many of the facts that they should be privy to.
Haven't we in the past, when we've looked at that test, haven't we included an after-a-fact assessment of what actually was happening that may not have been known to an observer?
Certainly, you can look at while it may not have been known to the observer, you can look at all the facts as they actually occurred. The risk, and I think the way that the CCA applied it, is it allows the rule to be swallowed. If we take it to such an extent that we're really testing for how many of if we allow all of the facts to be known, all of the facts of the affidavits, and effectively we're testing for actual bias. We're looking into the judge's mind to say, well, if you were aware, you saw the judge accompany back into chambers, but if the judge is saying that they were not actually biased, then there is no perception problem. And I think that's where we start to really swallow the rule.
You're relying on the risk of undermining the public's confidence in the judicial process, correct? That's
yes.
The basis, your main...
Yes, Judge Baker, I certainly think that is...
What are your three best arguments as to why public confidence in the judicial process is undermined, knowing all the facts as we do, in fact, including the fact that we're here today looking at this and how the CCA ruled, et cetera?
Looking at prong three of Liljeburg, Your Honor, we think some of the strongest argument is the language of the CCA itself. They found that these facts were troubling. When we have here we're one step beyond a reasonable man. We're at the point of a reasonable person with legal training who's perceiving this to be...
I'm looking for a shopping list here. Just tell me the three things that will undermine confidence in the judicial process.
It's the due process concern of the guarantee that there's going to be a tribunal that both is fair and appears to be fair being undercut by these interactions.
That sounds circular to me. What is it precisely that will lead them to think it's not fair?
Depending on the point where they are viewing the proceeding, they could draw an inference that there is an assistance to the prosecution, where there is this private communication across the bar, and that...
So point one is you have the communication between the judge in the stands and the prosecutor.
And I think that...
And why isn't that cured or clarified or mitigated by knowing what, in fact, the prosecutor did or did not do in response?
I think that, Judge Baker, it's not it is not mitigated because of the failure, the 902D1 sua sponte duty of the military judge to disclose these facts on the record and then seek waiver from the parties. So it's not mitigated because they never discussed it openly on the record. They never disclosed what the troubling facts and the interactions and exactly what the role of the senior judge sitting in the gallery was, especially at the point that the interactions occurred. And I think that a second point under the same prong of Liljeburg would be that this individual was the presiding military judge is solely responsible for sentencing in this case because it was military judge alone. And so they have a... they have such an instrumental role there in providing a sentence for appellant that could potentially be influenced by the other person, by the senior judge who's accompanying back into the
process. Is there any fact that indicates that occurred?
We're not alleging an actual...
You're just showing off of appearance there.
Absolutely, Your Honor, yes, that perception problem.
Do you agree we're working under a plein air standard?
Your Honor, we argue in our brief that it is abuse of discretion. We believe that the sua sponte duty is enough to put this into abuse of discretion, just like this court's opinion in Quintana in 2001, where there wasn't necessarily an objection. However, even applying plein air, we're still testing for prejudice under the Liljeburg analysis.
You're building the Liljeburg analysis into the materially prejudice of substantial right in that framework?
Yes, Your Honor, we are.
Do you think your case would be weaker or stronger if these interactions had been secret and hidden as opposed to open and notorious? So discovered at a later point because no one knew about it as opposed to open and notorious for everyone to see?
Your Honor, it seems to me that our real question is looking at what that reasonable observer in the courtroom would have seen. So if it's a matter that they would have had absolutely no ability to see this process unfolding, then I think it's a different case. I mean, if they didn't see the communication, if they didn't see accompanying back into chambers, I think that's a different case. I can't think of it.
I agree it would be a different case. My question is, do you think that it would make your case weaker or stronger? Do you think that a reasonable person of the public knowing all the facts to include either that these things just happened out in the open or that they happened secretly behind closed doors, which do you think would make more of an impact on the public's perception?
I think it would make more of an impact on the public's perception that it happened out in the open. Now, if it's things that came to light later that were particularly egregious, then that could conceivably be a strong case if there was some sort of direct financial incentive that was never disclosed previously or some sort of communication, some sort of undue influence at a later time. I see that a lot of time.
I've got a couple of questions, if we have a minute here.
Yes, Chief Judge.
What does the record establish as to whether the second military judge saw the first military judge pass notes to the prosecutor?
It doesn't clearly establish.
Thank you. So let's assume in this case that the first military judge erred by passing notes to the prosecutor about a matter dealing with the substance of the case, that the first military judge further erred by initiating a conversation with the second military judge about the substance of the case without being asked to do so by the second military judge, and that the first military judge further erred by not disclosing to the second military judge that the first military judge was passing notes to the prosecution about the substance of the case, and that none of that was placed on the record during the case. If we're dealing with a providence inquiry, and if, with respect to a providence inquiry, there could be a circumstance in which the notes passed by the first military judge affected the nature of the providence inquiry, such as to, for example, divert the parties from what may have been a defense or a real issue in the case. Let's assume that there could be such an error. Is there such an error in this case? And that is, in what manner did the communication from the first military judge to the prosecutor in any way prejudice the accused in this case? I understand all the arguments about appearances, but in terms of actual prejudice, what was there in the content of that communication that would constitute prejudice in this case?
Your Honor, I think we're looking at it as an objective test of what somebody would have viewed, what the reasonable person would have viewed. So the content, I believe, goes a bit more towards an actual bias question, but even under the perception problem, that direct communication that the other party wasn't privy to in the room could still create that appearance that there is an assistance only to one party that is not offered to both parties. And I think that is the potential for prejudice under the hypothetical that you're on.
Thank you. You have a further opportunity on rebuttal.
Thanks.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Efron, judges of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Stephen Latino, and along with Major Amber Williams, represent the government. A reasonable person, knowing all the facts of this case, would not question the military judge's impartiality. Applying a plain error standard of review, coupled with the applicable law for refusal from Butcher, this court should find the military judge was impartial over Collins' guilty plea.
Counsel, I have the same question for you. At what point are we charging this reasonable person with knowing all the facts? Now, we do talk about the fact that it's a reasonable person observing the proceedings. So that seems to indicate that we're not going to look at what they might learn after the fact, but we're looking at what they are going to perceive from watching the proceedings themselves.
Your Honor, it's the government's position that it's the everything that's known, including what was observed in the courtroom and outside. And I would rely on U.S. v. Wright, 52 MJ 136 at 141, when the court said, despite being an objective standard, the judge's statements concerning his intentions and matters upon which he relies are not irrelevant. Because that statement does not narrowly say on the record, I think this allows this court to look outside just what the reasonable person observing the proceedings would be. Nevertheless, even if we were just confined to the courtroom itself and what was observed in the courtroom, the government believes it still prevails because this was a guilty plea, and the facts, the appellant was not harmed by anything that actually happened inside of the courtroom.
This really looks bad, doesn't it? I mean, this is
What's going on here?
You know,
you got a reservist as a judge. By the way, can you tell me something? Who rates trial judges in the Army?
Your Honor, I believe, and I am not certain, but I believe it would be that supervising judge would be the first.
So she was his rater?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Oh, well, that makes it even more interesting. Okay, you've got two judges. One's presiding in the courtroom. The other, his rater and evidently his mentor, is sitting there saying, you're doing it all wrong. You screwed up. Trial counsel, call for a recess. I mean, if I'm, you know, the neutral observer sitting out there, what am I going to think? I mean, this is pretty bad, isn't it?
Your Honor, it's not the government's position that this was a good course of action or the best technique that could have been used. However,
if I may interject for a moment with my colleague, at what point did the, if any, did the Court of Criminal Appeals identify an error in this case on the part of either the first or the second military judge?
They did not, Your Honor.
This is a case in which there's no error in the view of the Court of Criminal Appeals.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Well, they said we assume without deciding, so.
Right.
Is that what we're dealing with?
From the Court, yes, Your Honor, is that they just assume without deciding that they disclose of the issue via no prejudice.
Okay, well, would you answer my question?
Oh, well, Your Honor, it was not the best course of action. It was not I'm afraid I forgot your question, Your Honor.
This looks really bad, and it's made even worse by the fact that you think she's his raider.
Your Honor, what the government rely on is this
the question, bad? Yeah, the question is, what do we do with this mess?
Your Honor, what we can do with this is we look at it from a reasonable person in the courtroom. They understand that the appellant is coming to the courtroom to plead guilty. And everything that the supervising judge did was to help the accused get to that stage where he would be provident to his guilty plea.
But the reasonable observer in the courtroom has no idea of what the intentions of the first judge were, the supervising judge, or has any idea other than watching this judge interfere in the proceedings and seem to have some kind of a role that, you know, is not normal, certainly.
Your Honor, I believe when you look at all the facts, although it was highly irregular, I think when you look at all the facts, it is the appellant was not prejudiced that there was no error in what occurred in the courtroom.
So what saves you are the after-the-fact statements of the individuals who are involved?
Your Honor, those certainly help the government. I believe, though, that what happened inside the courtroom itself does not rise to the level of error. Had this been a contested case, I think it would be a totally different, you'd look at the case totally different, but everything that occurred in the courtroom to a reasonable observer would be to help the accused be provident to his guilty plea.
So the CCA's findings, or whatever they are in this paragraph on JA-12, that it was an irregular communication and it lacked timely and full disclosure on the record, that builds confidence.
When you take that by itself, Your Honor, I would not say that it would build confidence, but when you take in all the facts and circumstances, that it was the military judge's first court-martial, that it was a supervising judge helping him with the non-adversarial proceedings of a guilty plea, the pretrial agreement, to make sure that the
appellant... Is the person locked into a guilty plea?
No, Your Honor.
Guilty plea or nothing, in your view, or they could have backed out, right? Or said, I don't want to do this, or I don't like the looks of this?
Yes, Your Honor, they could back out. And that's why it's important for the military judge to go over that pretrial agreement so that it's on the record that the accused, that everything that's in that agreement is what he agrees to.
If defense counsel had objected, would this be a different case? If defense counsel had objected and taken this out of plain error, would this be a different case?
Your Honor, it would depend on what actions after he objected. If he objected, of course, it would be under an abuse of discretion. But what the military judge would do in response to that objection would probably be what that case would rely on. If they put all the facts on the record and discussed the issue, I think it would not take it out of the realm of this case where there is no error and there is no prejudice.
Thank you.
Are you arguing there is no error?
Yes, Your Honor. The government believes there is no error in this case.
Now, was there any obligation of the judicial canon cited by the CCA with regard to the second military judge who's presiding at the time?
Yes, Your Honor, the Army Court said it under Canon 2, Rule 2.9, the Army's Code of Judicial Conduct for trial and appellate judges, and this allows for a judge to have contact with other judges, provided that the judge makes reasonable efforts to avoid receiving actual information that is not part of the record and does not abrogate the responsibility personally to decide the matter. And then we have the affidavit from the military judge stating that he did not feel as though the supervising judge usurped his deliberative authority necessarily.
So in your view, there's no issue with the judicial canons? The trial judge followed the judicial canons in this instance?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, counsel, given the basis of the CCA's decision below, which is that they assumed error and that you didn't appeal that, what are we supposed to do with your assertion now that there is no error? Don't we have to proceed on the assumption that we will assume error also?
Your Honor, this court can assume that there was error based on the Army Corps' decision, but applying the entire plain error standard, I think this court can visit that issue.
Well, do you agree or disagree that let me ask it a different way. Do you believe that your stronger argument or stronger position is that there was no error or that there was no prejudice?
No, I think the stronger the two arguments would be that there is no prejudice.
Let's go back to the error question. Did the Court of Criminal Appeals address at all whether the first military judge, we keep talking about the supervisory judge, let's just talk about that first military judge as the judge detailed to this case. That first military judge who is detailed to this case, is judge of record in this case, and then is sitting in the audience in the courtroom after having ceded control of the case to a second judge. Is that first judge allowed to pass notes to the prosecution in the course of the case about anything dealing with the case?
In the context of this case, Your Honor, where it's a guilty plea, although it does not look the best, I think under the reasonable person standard with the plain error standard, I believe that does not rise to the level of a plain and obvious error.
So it's the view that we should write an opinion saying the judge does this again, that's okay?
No, Your Honor, just as in...
I'm not talking about what should be or what's nice or what recommended practice. Is that permissible? That is, can a judge sit as a presiding judge in a case, then pass the case to another judge, and then the first judge, can that judge sit in the courtroom and provide ex parte contacts to the prosecution or to the defense, to any party in the case, about the substance of the case?
Your Honor, to the substance of the case, I would say no.
About anything dealing with the case in terms of whether the individual is pleading providently or not. So that is that then an exception to the substance of the case, that the first judge can sit in the courtroom and pass notes to either party about the providence inquiry, ex parte?
No, yeah. Your Honor, a supervising judge should not do that. But whether it's the issue is whether it would be plain and obvious. And under the facts of this case...
Under what theory is it not plain and obvious that a judge should not be engaged in ex parte communications with a party in the case?
Your Honor, the government would rely once again on Canon 2 of Rule 2.9 that allows the contact between military judges.
I'm not talking about the contact between the judges. We're just talking about the contact between the judge and the party. You've got the first military judge in this case passing notes to the counsel regarding the substance of the providence inquiry.
Do you have paragraph B there in the judicial canons?
I do not, Your Honor.
Do you have it available to you? You might want to refer to it in response to Judge Efron's question.
Your Honor, if the government assumes that is error, there still would not be any prejudice in this case. And to answer Judge Stuckey's question, he asked the appellant about whether it's structural error or not. The government has 3 points on why it is a non-structural error. The first would be Article 59 Alpha, which says the finding of sentence of a court-martial may not be held incorrect on the ground of an error of law unless the error materially prejudices the substantial right of the accused. Second, in U.S. v. Hargrove and U.S. v. Mangiari, both tested for prejudice in cases where they were alleged constitutional.
Okay, counsel, I didn't understand the appellant to be arguing for structural error. Maybe I'm wrong, but go ahead.
And finally, when you look at structural errors, are those which are inherently prejudicial and where prejudice is unquantifiable or irrelevant? And it's not the case here. This is a case where one can test for prejudice.
Let's go back to error again now, talk about the communication between the first judge and the second judge. Can you cite a canon or a precedent in which it is permissible for a person who sits as a judge in a case and is no longer sitting to initiate communication with the second judge in the case? But as I understand the process by which a presiding judge can consult, but here we have the first judge initiating a communication, not at the request of the second judge, but the first judge's own initiative. And what would be the authority under the canons or any precedent for the first judge to initiate that communication?
Your Honor, the government does not at this time have any canons or case law that would support that proposition.
Thank you.
Looking at prejudice and looking at some of the facts of this case, which show that there are no prejudices, that the recess itself actually benefited the appellant by helping his providency to the guilty plea. The fact the defense counsel didn't believe there was any form of judicial misconduct. The plea of guilty also helped rid the appellant of a pending Article 15 for a positive urinalysis. And the military judge stated himself at Joint Appendix 141 and 142 that he deliberated the accused sentence himself. And in fact,
You've already answered this question. I must have missed it. Are we testing under Lillibridge factors, or are we testing under 59?
Under Lillibridge factors, Your Honor. And finally, the appellant received less jail time for the military.
So in, it is possible, then, as a matter of theory, that appellant got everything he wanted and then some and thought he got the greatest deal that ever happened, but public confidence could be shattered by something. What happens in that case where the appellant gets everything he wants, he walks out of that court and whispers to his lawyer, boy, did I get a good deal. And meanwhile, everybody else is calling the newspaper saying, what's this court-martial system all about? It's a crock. Who wins in that case on prejudice?
Your Honor, in that case, it would be the appellant who would actually win, I believe, under those facts, because the public confidence would not be behind the court system, even if the appellant felt as though he received all the benefit of the bargain. However, the appellant would also have the option if he to take his case out of appellate review if he did not want to have anything changed to it.
But your answer then, in part, should it not also indicate that the appellant's perception is in fact the appellant's perception part of the all the facts or not? This is the snapshot question again.
Your Honor, I believe with the...
Your first point, though, is Lillibridge is the prejudice analysis here.
Yes, Your Honor. And it's the government's position that the snapshot would occur knowing all the facts. And as the objective standard, look at the subjective intent or the subjective thought of the appellant as to whether he thought he got the greatest deal in the world or if he felt prejudiced. But it wouldn't be that controlling, no matter if the appellant thought he got the greatest deal in the world or the worst deal in the world. Because you have to look at all the facts. Subject to any questions, we ask this court to affirm the Army Court's decision.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Going back to a few of Your Honor's questions, Judge Stuckey, JA 139 discloses that, in fact, this was a senior raider issue. It's at paragraph 1. I was assigned the United States Army Fourth Judicial Circuit. My raider and supervising judge, was Colonel Boudreaux, regular Army, then assigned as the Chief Circuit Judge. Again, that's JA 139,
okay.
Paragraph 1.
Thank you.
Actually, paragraph 2, even though it's labeled paragraph 1. Also, to Judge Baker's questions about the canons, I don't have all of the canons with me, but certainly speaking to, I think it's subsection B, and the this is really a combination with Judge Ephraim's question. It's the language is that a judge may consult with court personnel whose function is to aid the judge in carrying out the judge's adjudicative responsibilities, or with other judges. We would urge the court not to to overread that as ignoring the due process concerns that are still present. And so while certain communications, as were appropriate in this court's opinion, I believe it was in Baker, there can be some communications back in chambers. The problem here is the perception problem. It's not just the judges communicating. It's also the combination of that communication going on in open court through an ex parte communication. And the additional point to Judge Ephraim's question, it may not even be entirely appropriate for the communication to be initiated by the judge who is sitting in the back rather than the judge who is sitting in the front.
Well, let's turn that question the other way then, and that is there any precedent to the contrary? And that is, if a judge is sitting in a courtroom in an area in which that judge has general jurisdiction, although not specific involvement in the case, let's assume that's a hypothetical, may the judge initiate an inquiry or a conversation with the presiding judge at some point about matters that have taken place in the courtroom? What do you, is there something expressed either in the canons, that precedent, that tell us one way or another about that type of initiation?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of a case that would be directly on point to that question as to whether or not that person could initiate the communication, but I think certainly drawing analogy to some of this court's own precedent, it would not be appropriate if it were more than merely de minimis communication. Looking at some of the discussion that this court revealed in the Quintana opinion in 2001, you left some space for the possibility of de minimis communications in an ex parte function, but certainly not not condoning any sort of substantive communication directly through one party and not the other, Your Honor. So on that note, I think we'll agree with the government that it doesn't look the best to have this direct communication, and I think that is really the crux of our argument. I think that really our strongest point is under prong three of Loebert, and notwithstanding the minimal prong one impact, we think that prong three is so strong. And as this court has previously found, looking at the McElwain 2008 opinion, it's not necessarily that all three prongs need to be so strong. In fact, I believe this court's language was that prong two's impact in that case was minimal, and yet still grants relief to appellant. We think it is appropriate that there is a demonstration of some impact on all three prongs, and especially where that corrosive impact on public confidence in the appearance problem, that due process concern, and exactly what the system will be perceived to be if we have essentially a training program in the military that looks like this, where our first court-martial for a judge is the first time that they're ever even going to practice.
When you're talking about appearances, could you address the relationship of the appearances from the defense counsel's post-trial request for clemency and the staff judge advocate's recommendation and the convening authority's granting of clemency in light of the apparently full disclosure of this particular problem? Why doesn't that take care of the appearance issue in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, I see that I'm short on time, but
you can take the time you need to answer that question and then to briefly conclude unless there are other questions from my colleagues.
I believe to your question, Your Honor, the post-trial clemency matters are purely a discretionary matter of the convening authority.
And so I understand that. I understand that it's not a waiver. But what about the issue of appearance? Why doesn't that address the appearance in this case when the defense is saying there was a problem here and this will take care of the problem from my perspective?
I think it doesn't address the appearance because the reasonable observer, the member of the public viewing the process, was still viewing a court-martial where you had a violation of the guarantee to a tribunal that is impartial and appears to be impartial. So I think that it is not the appropriate cure and the convening authority.
But why can't they view the remedy that was asked for? Why do you have to cut it off at the trial If there's a reasonable observer, why can't they observe a remedy requested and granted?
Your Honor, I think because it still neglects the sua sponte duty of the judge to do the candid disclosure on the record and seek the waiver from the parties on the record at the time of the proceeding.
You may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. We believe that the appropriate remedy under Liljeburg, and especially prong three, is reversal in this case.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both parties for your presentation in the case. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess pending further order of the court.
Court stands adjourned until further order.